Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. This is program number 800, and it is April the 6th, 1987. Last week, I was talking about five very dangerous people whose operations can be related to each other by agents and agencies, and I forgot to include number six. For those of you who missed the broadcast, or in case I went too fast, or even if you know it, I'm going to list them again for you, because they tie into past broadcasts that I've done and will, of course, affect the future, and they're very important. One was Reverend Potter Gale, who's now in jail, I believe on a $1 million bond. He was arrested for planned violence and murder in Las Vegas. Gale's a founder of the Ministry of Christ, the leader of the identity movement, that violent identity which has plans to kill all the Jews and blacks in America. He's closely associated with Richard Butler in Idaho. And Butler was a former Lockheed employee working on the U-2. Juan Lopez Rega was picked up in the Bahamas and then arrested in Florida. He's the interior minister for Juan Perón in Argentina. He was flown to Argentina. He headed the 3A, the AAA, the death squads, not the automobile club. He worked with Klaus Barbie and with associated closely with American intelligence, with links to the World Anti-Communist League, to terrorism in Central America, with the Contras. He's a part of Licio Gelli, the P2 organization, and the scandals surrounding the Vatican Bank, the missing money, and the late Roberta Calvi, the late Michele Sindona. Franklin Camper is standing trial right now for firebombing the home of two teachers in California. He runs the terrorist school in Alabama that has notoriously almost bragged about training the Sikhs, the gentleman suspected of blowing up Air India, and they also put bombs on a plane that blew up in Japan before it was in flight over the water going to India. Francesco Pazienza is in a jail with hints, I read, in an article to name Alexander Haig and Michael Ledeen as his contacts. He's a liaison of the Vatican to the CIA, to the Republican Party, close contacts in Rome with Michael Ledeen through the whole story of developing the pseudo-plot that didn't work, that Aja worked for the KGB and the Bulgarians. Pazienza is currently locked up and being tried for the Bologna bombing that killed 80 people and injured many, many more. The bombing was in 1980. The trial is just taking place now. Stefano Della Calle was arrested March the 20th. A very exciting arrest outside of the late Otto Skorzeny, who was a source of influence to him. Stefano Della Calle had fascist, neo-fascist contacts all over the world, and he finally was picked up in Venezuela, and he was sent back to Italy, and he will stand trial there. He's a well-known fugitive, also wanted for many, many charges involved with drug trafficking and linked to the Barbie Mengele Venezuela-Bolivia connections, which also tie to the United States. The sixth arrest that I forgot to list among that cast is Carlos Letter Rivas. He was arrested February the 5th, and he's so important to the cocaine. He was the head of the cocaine cartel, and two of his top henchmen from that group, Pablo Escobar and Jorge Osha, are defendants in the Christic Institute case against the Contras for their drug dealing, assassination, attempted coups, and so forth. There's a lot of significance in the fact that the most conservative president in the United States, with the most links to all six of these people through his entire political career, and I've done many broadcasts on those associations, it's interesting that these people have been rounded up in this time and place and were allowed to roam when the more liberal, if you can say liberal, administrations were in power and these people were allowed to do the things they want. Now, I just want to bring up a few subjects that are very important to cover them, to let you know I'm in touch with them, and then I want to continue with Accuracy in Media Part 2, where I left off last week. And 3 weeks ago, I briefly mentioned that agency and Reed Irvine, who's in charge of it. There was an article in the People's World this past week that the Israeli government has the neutron bomb. The article goes this way, February 28, 1987. Neutron bombs stored in Israel. The United States has stockpiled neutron bombs in Israel and has agreed to their use in case a war breaks out, the Egyptian newspaper Al-Wafed said this week. The newspaper said the United States has been storing neutron bombs in Italy and in Germany in the past 6 months. Under the Strategic Cooperation Agreement signed by U.S. and Israel in 1983, Al Waff had said 1,000 such munitions were shipped to Israel. The paper concludes that by stationing the neutron warheads in Israel, the U.S. has actually equipped the Rapid Deployment Force with them and plans to use them in the Middle East or permit Israel to do so. So whether they came from the United States or made in Israel, you heard it first on World Watchers, and the important connection that is yet to be made is that Israel and the United States, with the encouragement of people like John Singh Lau, William Casey, and Alexander Haig, tested the neutron bomb in Cameroon. That was the neutron bomb. And finally, 8 months later, there's the admission, yes, Israel has it and can use it. And this was a little mini warning. I'm sure the Soviet Union got the message when those 1,800 people lay down and the cattle lay down and just nicely and quietly died. Now, there's a book out called Target America, The Influence of Communist Propaganda on the Media, written by James Tyson. It was published by Regnery Press, which is a CIA press, in 1981. And the introduction was written by Reed Irvine of Accuracy in Media. And interestingly enough, in this book, it explains that the communists in Moscow use the American press, that the American press is such a threat because they use it for reprinting what we say for their particular propaganda. Now, our American press is there to inform us. If the Soviet Union uses it, that's all right. But what Reed Irvine doesn't want is that they pick it up and learn what is going on from the American press. And they used an example of the way the Central Committee of the Communist Party in Moscow works. This book on page 31 says, for example, in quotes, get the United States out of China, end quotes, quote, destroy the CIA, and another quote, kill the neutron bomb. These are implemented by the International Department under Ponarev and the Information Department under Zamatin. Their department gets specialized assistance from the KGB, especially in disinformation directorate. Now, I'm wondering, in 1971, if the Russians were quoting American press, did we know about a neutron bomb? I'll have to look that up. Does a neutron bomb go back to 71? I'm not sure it does, but for kill the neutron bomb, maybe that's when the idea first came up, and the years go pretty fast, but that was one of the examples that the Soviet Union had reprinted from the United States press. Nation magazine has an article by Christopher Hitchens, March 28, 1987, sent to me by a World Watcher subscriber, and I appreciate these. And this article is about Israel having the atomic bomb and the comparison to the way they treat Vanunu, as of Jonathan Pollard, who was a spy, and Vanunu simply told the world that Israel had this particular bomb and the capability. And this is quite a long article with the reason it's believable that Israel has the atomic bomb based upon the parts that they needed to make it, the uranium and so forth, the uranium ore. But the important thing is that at the bottom of this article, there's a phone number I called today that no one was there, Judy Zimmet, Mordecai Vanunu Legal Defense Fund. And I'm going to call her and ask her if Christopher Hitchens and she have ever thought about the fact that the secrecy that is around Vanunu has to do with a neutron bomb and that it has less to do with the Israelis' capability with atomic bombs. I have an article dated March 30th, 1987, titled, Will France Deploy the Neutron Bomb? And this is what it says. The neutron bomb has been developed but not deployed by France. It may be deployed given the possibility that NATO will accept Mr. Gorbachev's zero option, the removal of U.S. missiles from Europe. The RPR party, the Gaullist party of Premier Jacques Chirac, is now supporting the neutron bomb deployment, according to party spokesman Frank Borota. Speaking to the press in Paris on March the 6th, he stressed the importance of Western countries reinforcing their military potential in the case the United States withdraws. The neutron bomb is one of the conventional rebalancing elements, he said. The neutron bomb is an anti-personnel weapon capable of being fired in conventional artillery shells It has been described as doing to the ground what the American Strategic Defense Initiative and related European programs are projected to do in the air against Soviet missiles. No ground force could withstand the effects of the neutron bomb. As a defensive weapon, it would provide European nations with a means of halting Soviet armored assault dead in the tracks. And then there was another large article, February 24th of this year, a month and a half ago. Nuclear report says Israel could level much of the Middle East. Israel may have acquired enough nuclear weaponry to level every urban center in the Middle East with a population of 100,000 or more. And considering that South Africa and Pakistan have the nuclear technology, this gives a grave danger for the next decade. And this report of wiping out the cities in the Middle East is based on the information of Mordecai Vanhanu. But the other article, the more recent one, just that small one, about Israel and the United States depositing neutron bombs, allowing them to be deposited in Israel, is very much in keeping with what I believed happened with the, in quotes, testing or the warning. We tested the atomic bomb, but the purpose, we discovered later, was to warn the Soviet Union of what the United States had. We tested the neutron bomb in Cameroon for the same purposes. And I don't know why the left, writing, or, you know, people who are pretty sharp about other things have missed the point about Cameroon. I think part of it is because, again, these things are tested on people of black skin or orange skin, yellow skin. If it happened in an American or a British country or in Canada and 18 people fell dead, there would be a lot of investigation. There's a certain amount of racism in turning the other way because it happened in Cameroon. They know very well where to test it, and it's up to people to wake up and push this to the brink and get an admission that, yes, Shimon Peres, with the United States, tested the neutron bomb last August in Cameroon. Now, another story that I was right on top of, ahead of anybody, and that will still develop for years to come. Chernobyl is going to try certain personnel. They're going on trial because of mishaps at the nuclear plant. The nuclear plant accident, I said, was a sabotage. And now certain people, the director of the plant and other officials who were fired, they were expelled from the Communist Party. They're going on trial, and they evidently weren't burned or touched by it. It caused 31 deaths, the evacuation of 130,000 people. And there's going to be a trial for those people that allowed it to happen, and the trial will be taking place about April 26th, I think, and with charges that when the explosion ripped through Chernobyl and sent a radioactive cloud throughout Europe, that they did not warn the head of the Soviet Union for at least 24 hours or more, and also by doing that, they allowed the information to come in. This won't be in the trial, but it came in from the USIA and the Radio Free America and so forth, so that it looked like the people on the outside cared more about persons living in the area than the Soviet Union themselves, and the other officials had not been notified. Another, just one more item before we get to accuracy in media. You've been reading about the war crimes files that belong to history. This is from the New York Times, again, sent to me by a friend from the Kansas City Times. This has to do with the files of former Nazi war criminals that should be available to everybody, but which are locked up in the United Nations for absolutely no reason at all, and think about what the reason would be. This article says there are news stories that simply will not go away. The press forgets them. The bureaucrats try to hide them. The government tries to wipe them from national memories, and every once in a while they come up. This is about the United Nations, the secret archives of Nazi war criminals, hidden from historians, hidden from journalists for 40 years. There is no reason for them to be refusing to open them up. There's a deep reluctance on the part of the officials to open them up. In 1948, the Allied War Crimes Commission went out of business. They turned over files on 38,000 people who were war criminals, and they gave it to the United Nations that was 3 years old. The commission, 17 nations, never expected them to be put away and locked up. Imagine how much the world could change with 38,000 known war criminals protected by the United Nations. About 25,000 names were on a special A list, and there was enough evidence to warrant a prosecution. The commission decided in 1946 to remove the list from the secret category. Quite logical. How could war criminals be prosecuted when the names and charges were secret? The commission said the archives were a valuable record for historians. Historians do not write secret books. About a year ago, they were entrusted to the United Nations. The officials decided it would be best to lock them away, open them only once in a while, and one of those times came in 1986 when Kurt Waldheim, former head of the United Nations, was believed to have been guilty of war crimes, and more of those have been revealed just in the past week. 9 months ago, the pesky Israelis got confidential access to 300 more files, and they asked Secretary General Javier Perez de Suellar to open the file so scholars and journalists could examine them. Veteran UN specialists agreed with Israel that it was within the power of the Secretary General now, at this time, to open the archives that the UN had closed. But the Secretary General said he had to ask former members of different states. The Israelis have asked for the name of 2,000 more, but they insist the issue, in any case, is public access. The Israeli position is that the secrecy issue created by the United Nations staff runs counter to what was the original intent of the commission, that there is a master list of names and summary of charges, and it found its way to a public American archive in Maryland. And it's time to open that up. Now, Nelson Rockefeller and the Rockefeller family put in a good deal of money into building the United Nations in New York. Henry Kissinger was very close, of course. He's on the board of Chase Manhattan, to the Rockefeller family, and as is his mentor, Fritz Kramer, the two of them, and John J. McCloy from the Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank as an attorney and representative for them, they put Henry Kissinger in Harvard. What if one of those names is number 33, the prisoner at Dachau prison? Now, we have a prisoner who did mass crimes against British in Greece and in Yugoslavia, who became the head of the United Nations, and that was a very visible career, became president of Vienna. Then you have another war criminal who has hardly been seen by anyone who doesn't know who he really is, that man with the monocle known as Fritz Kramer. And there are lists of people from Krakow, Poland, friends of Karol Wojtyla when he lived there and worked for IG Farben. And these names are protected. And the importance of Fritz Kramer is that they're leading us to World War III now. And by not having those names, we are going to pay the penalty for what they've built up and developed, which is hopefully World War III. Just one more item, which, again, I was right about, and I was right about within 24 hours. FBI probes Seacole in shuttle disaster. You loyal World Watchers know this story. The FBI is conducting a criminal investigation of Morton Thiokol, the company that made the rocket seals blamed for the space shuttle disaster, the Challenger disaster. A presidential commission blamed the explosion on the failure of a joint on the right rocket booster. The joint failed because cold weather prevented rubber pressure seals from holding back gases, the commission concluded. The FBI investigation revealed in court papers filed in connection with the lawsuit against Thiokol by Roger Bourgelet, a former engineer for the company who worked on the shuttle project. He pleaded with his superiors and NASA not to allow the launch in 38-degree weather. He's accused his former employer of lying to congressional committees and the presidential commission. In his lawsuit, Bourgelet accused Thiokol of falsely telling NASA that the rubber seals known as the O-rings were safe in cold weather. He accused them of lying when they knew it. That's also in the Wall Street Journal today, April the 6th, that it was not safe to launch the shuttle in cold weather. He said the company officials conspired to defraud the government when they said that NASA said it was safe to launch it in cold temperatures. The accident occurred because the boosters, which were built by the company, were not able to perform properly in cold weather that prevented the launch that day. Now, the second half of that story, like the second half of the Van de Noon story and the neutron bombs in Israel, which is the testing in Cameroon, The second half of this story is, why was the launch day set for Saturday? Saturday was warm for the Challenger. They pushed it up to Sunday, and that was the special football game, the big game of the year. Okay, so instead the astronauts went bicycle riding. They saw it was going to be cold on Monday, and they waited for the coldest day. And sure enough, the day that the president was going to give his speech, his State of the Union message on Tuesday, was mighty cold. On Monday, they had a little trouble with the hatch door and a screwdriver and closing the hatch and what they called all kinds of silly hijinks where they didn't have a battery for their screwdriver and put it off. So the question, of course, is why they were lying about making it go up in the cold, but why they waited for the cold and why the people at Huntsville, Alabama, ordered the people at Morton Thiokol to change their decision. The ultimate decision is in the White House and in Huntsville, Alabama. What happened when they forced the others? That's the chain of command from the top down, and Morton Thiokol couldn't do it on their own and wouldn't do it on their own. So Beaujolais, Roger Beaujolais, is making the suit against the company he worked for, but the other is the bottom line, and so much for that. Now, last week I was talking about Reed Irvine, the head of accuracy and media, how he wrote a letter to the president at Foothill College and told him he was very upset. This is Dr. Tom Clement in Los Altos Hills, the location of where KFJC is and where David Emery is on the air with Nip Tuck. And he mentioned him in his letter, and he said he was upset by the fact that on their program they suggested that the government could affect heart or cancer and suicides and get rid of certain people. And he noted that they even had references about the assassination of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King. And this is very key to Reed Irvine's connections. And he objected to references to the World Anti-Communist League and those operations. And the president of the university said that, well, if this was true, he would take action to see that it was stopped, if that's a correct quote. I don't know if it is or not. But last week I was referring to the book, again, The Last Hero, how a corporation was set up in May when the war was over, the British American Canadian Corporation. And by April the 2nd, 1947, it changed its name to the World Commerce Corporation, headquarters in New York, registered in Panama. And the people tied into this, William Stevenson, Intrepid, was involved with the Kennedy assassination, with Albert Osborne, who sat on a bus with Mr. Norton, Don Norton, the double for Lee Harvey Oswald, and they passed through Montego Bay, the headquarters of William Stevenson in the Bahamas. And I cited various people directly involved in a lot of the Contragate and the political work that we've done through the years, hundreds of corporations that Mr. Donovan of the OSS put together with British intelligence after the war. Donovan helped set up this British American Canadian corporation that became the World Commerce Corporation. Donovan was working very closely with another person well known to Reed Irvine and on the board of the founding of Reed Irvine's operation, and that was none other than former Secretary of State Dean Acheson. And the people named in The Last Hero, the Richard Mellon Scaife family, are close to Accuracy and Media and Reed Irvine. But the very agencies that set up from the OSS to the CIA and use these corporations are directly involved with the persons on the board of directors of Accuracy and Media and Reed Irvine and his entire operation. I'll give you a few examples, and then I want to go to the board members of Accuracy in Media, a few of them. In the magazine Covert Action, this is spring 1984, they begin with a description of how this got started. Every one of these little dummy fronts has a bigger background where it mushrooms. It looks small, but behind it are a lot of giants. It's the same thing is happening with Contragate when Albert Hakim comes out to Silicon Valley to buy Stanford Technology. It was the child of a monster, and he taps into the monster. And Reed Irvine has tapped and used and is part of this monster. And all he needed was Dean Acheson on the board of this organization when it got started. And he had entree to the whole group that are described in The Last Hero, the book about Donovan. I'm quoting, this is from Covert Action, accuracy in media's background. And I read a little bit of this on the air last week. I want to do just these two paragraphs over again. Its beginnings were modest with a reported $200. AIM was formed in September 1969. That's as soon as Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King were killed, and of course the media would be following their murders just as they did John Kennedy's assassination, and we did. And they became incorporated in 69, started in 69, incorporated in 71. That's when Henry Kissinger was in charge of the National Security Council. Richard Nixon had the COINTEL program, the MK Ultra, the operations against American citizens, opening mail, bag jobs, and so forth. But you're not supposed to tell people about that. It came out later. But this was formed in that time period. The original advisory board included, until his death in 71, former Secretary of State Dean Acheson. And that's a key name in addition to the others that joined here. The trio that signed the incorporation documents, comprised of John K. McLean, an investment broker and past publisher of Underground Conservative, Abraham Kalish, who worked from 1949 to 58 with the United States Information Agency, and from 58 to 71 at the U.S. Army's Defense Intelligence School. So he goes from there in 1971 to an organization that's going to affect accuracy in academia, teachers on campuses, and monitor what they do and tell the presidents of the university, and accuracy in media to listen and see who is getting out the truth, not the lies, and then get rid of them because they're telling the truth. Reed Irvine was born in 1922, a Mormon. He went into the Marines. He was a Japanese language officer in the Pacific. He worked in the War Department as a member of the U.S. occupation force in Japan, went to Oxford, England, came home, joined the Federal Reserve, and worked there for 25 years. In the early years, AIM was run by Abraham Kalish of the Defense Intelligence School, and he began with Reed Irvine, and then as the years went on, Irvine left the job of Federal Reserve and took on more importance with AIM. Their early tax return in 1971, 16 years ago, was $5,000. Now it was $51,000, but there's much more going on than that. Now, regarding, I'll go back to the board of directors and go to it forward in 1 minute. I just want to use some examples of Dean Acheson and the importance he had because he was one of the founders on the board, and these people are there for a reason. He was Deputy Secretary of Defense, then he was Secretary of Defense, but he was more than that. He worked with William Donovan and Alan Dulles of the OSS, CIA. Then he's in charge of hiring Frank Wiesner. If you read the Valera Secret, you find that Frank Wiesner recruited all the Nazis from Eastern Europe that infiltrated our intelligence system, and many were in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, creating a fabric of a lie about Lee Harvey Oswald, just as Michael Ledeen and Claire Sterling, Paul Hansen, Francesco Pazienza did the lie about the shooting of the Pope and making it the KGB. The whole fabric of using the white Russian czarists in the Dallas-Fort Worth area was to create a communist plot that killed John Kennedy. And these people fabricated a lot of stories, and the Warren Commission took the stuff out of context and didn't even need their fabrications or their lies, but had a multiple list of witnesses, some who never met the Oswalds, either one in their life or met them once or twice, and have so much to tell about the Lee Harvey Oswalds. The reason it's easy to follow the pattern of events such as Ajan, the story of the KGB, and the development is that it is identical to what happened during the Warren Commission hearings, and after spending 9 years reading those and retyping them and becoming an expert at the field of avoidance and staying away from the real issues and trying to taint what's your original cover story, you learn the process by using these witnesses. And Dean Acheson, one of the founders of AIM, again, had the network of the very people that were involved in the assassinations. That could explain why he doesn't like David Emery or Nip Tuck talking about who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, or Martin Luther King. We'll take a 1-minute break and get back to Reader Irvine and some more on accuracy in media.